Before we proceed to talk about these maps and the wall, I should like to make a few statements. Let us observe, firstly, that 3/5 of the people in the world live in Asia. Almost 98% of these are pagans or heathens. The people of Asia have never known freedom and peace as Christians know and enjoy freedom and peace. They have been slaves of sin, sinning and sinned against. They have been sinned against by their despotic rulers and by a privileged minority. On top of this, they have been sinned against by European colonial powers who used and exploited them. Their religions, their worldviews, and their ignorance have kept them and their lands underdeveloped. Now another master has arisen. A godless ideology, communism. Because of its seeming efficiency, it gives what it promises, food and unity that is backed by intimidation and force. No, Asians are not free under communism, for communism is an enemy of human freedom. Yet communism has already claimed more than half of the Asian continent and more than half of the people of Asia. Only the insular Asian countries, Japan, Taiwan, the Philippines, and Indonesia, seem to be free from an immediate takeover. Tens of thousands of islands and atolls scattered all over the Pacific are peopled mostly by Asians. It is reasonable to believe that there must be scores of thousands of people who live in the Pacific Basin besides those who inhabit the insular Asian countries already mentioned. Not many have been evangelized, much less enlightened to live as intelligent human beings should. Are Christians going to continue to be indifferent to the miserable destiny of this and the 2 billion people of Asia? This is the question and the challenge that Christianity must face. Its very existence will depend much, and its answer to the question and response to the challenge. Half of the people of the globe claimed commitment to Christianity at the turn of the century. Today, not even 1/3 of the world's population is Christian. This means that Christianity is not keeping up with the growth of world population. This also means that at the rate it is growing, hardly 1/4 of the population of the world will be Christian at the end of our century. What will this mean to the world, and certainly also to Christianity? It will mean tragedy for the many millions who are lost forever because they are without Christ. It will mean, perhaps, that Christianity will have succumbed to the forces of evil. It will have forfeited its role as the leavening power in society, in the world. Christianity appears to be losing out in Asia. it seems to have lost before it got started because of the colonial powers that represented the Christian West. They have proven to be the great stumbling block that made Christianity, even today, a hated religion among many Asians. It is suspected of being a tool of imperialism or an agent of foreign powers. The colonial system, in other words, has made it difficult for Christianity even to be heard. And it will not be heard unless some sort of reconciliation between the West and Asia will take place. Let us face it. East and West have reached extreme polarization in our days, due largely to the upsurge of negative nationalism among Asians, a kind of nationalism that is in retreat from the full resentment against the West. How then can reconciliation take place? Not by power politics, certainly. Not by diplomacy with its quid pro quo motivation. Opposing political ideologies are often irreconcilable. Cultures that clash cannot bring about mutual tolerance and understanding, much less friendship, unless a synthesis of the best in Western and Asian cultures take place. The strategy of attraction will take a long time. The strategy of mediation used by the Asians themselves is tediously slow. What then is the alternative? He who alone can bring peace to men wants to bring about this reconciliation. This he does through the word of reconciliation, which he has committed to God's people, to his church. Therefore, the church in the West cannot withdraw from Asia. It cannot, with a good conscience, withhold its witness from the 2 billion unevangelized people of Asia. If, as a structured church, it retreats from this challenge, it will have forfeited the faith and its usefulness. Indeed, it is not God's will that the church in America will cease to be a witness in Asia, notwithstanding the West's historical past in this hostile region of the world. Men will resist the truth, and unregenerated men, that is. They will resist God, even in his gracious appeal to be reconciled to men. For Asians are not any different in resisting the truth. They refuse to hear, especially since their culture inhibits them and Western colonialism has made it difficult for them to trust the Western missionaries. I have here a number of maps. Now, I have other things to share with you, especially, say, the involvement of the church in the study of this particular region of the world that had been so neglected by Christianity. So the church must venture out of its theological ghetto and involve itself in the stream of life if it wants to become a force in the world to change the world. Its course in history should find root also in the events that affect that course, as well as in its past of grandeur or of weakness, in its periods of separatistic denominationalism, or in its moments of unity in organization. Too often, the church has detached itself from secular concerns, from history, from geography, from the study of man's earthly domain, his sociology, and his politics. Missions of all the departments of theological studies should be concerned with the social disciplines as a part of the practical discipline. But the competence to make use of them to full advantage has to be developed. This is often shown in certain pointless methods of carrying out the Lord's commission and in the strategy that issues from lack of articulate knowledge of these disciplines, thinking of geography, history, and sociology with emphasis on Asian anthropology and culture. Wastage of manpower, time, and financial resources have resulted from this lack of better knowledge of the social disciplines that affect peoples and their cultures in the case of Asia. What does the mission administrator know about the economic, cultural, demographic, political, and historical life of Asian and Asian nations? When asked of any missionary in Asia, no doubt this question will reveal the strength or weakness of the missionary's preparation for his work among the Asians. Rather than stop with the question, it is more constructive to apply some, say, geographic thoughts in this study, just to reveal that the average would-be missionary to Asians knows much or too little about Asians. Asia is a vast continent. It contains one-third of the land surface of this terrestrial ball. It extends from the equator to the Arctic Circle and longitudinally halfway around the globe. But despite its vastness, Asia is not universally livable and productive. Fronting the north are wastelands that are economically useless for the present, useless for human habitation. Others are vast areas of arid deserts. Just as vast are the areas of highlands and mountains, barren of forests and unfit for economic exploitation. That is in contrast with the monsoonal Asia that I just described a while ago. Despite seven large rivers that exceed 2,500 miles each in length, there are hardly any watersheds between the Arctic and the Indian Ocean. It has instead many millions of square miles of drainage basins above and below sea level running north and south to form the core of the continent and to serve as barriers to land movement. Most of this core of Asia lies within the so-called land mass. East of the core of Asia lies Asiatic Asia, the region that lies in the monsoon regime where 10/11 of the Asian people live. Here, 80% of the rainfall is deposited during the warm months, which water that very geographic region attracting most of the people of Asia to live in this so-called monsoonal part of Asia. For monsoon Asia is a very definite region in contrast with Eurasia. The geography of China has been influenced by recent developments in history, to be sure. The economic and political geography of China has changed somewhat for the better to some and for the worse to others. The fact of the matter is that there is a semblance of unity and control, not to mention productivity. These observers say has been very successful. Thinking more of the recent unification of China, which has brought China to a stage in its history, an age of unity and possibly industrialization of that country, which naturally had shaken Soviet Russia to begin to be envious of the prosperity of China. Now, two recent Pacific wars only accentuated the role of this region geopolitically. With communism having gained national strength in China, it was bound to expand into non-communist regions if it was to live up to its ideal. Thus, it has begun its traditional practice of just provoking neighbors, sparring now and then with weaker ones. Because of this type of development in this region, there is uncertainty in Asia today. This only brings home to the church the need for a constant restudy of strategy. A more recent regionalization of Asia brings us to the term Asian Rim. This includes countries such as the two Koreas, China, the Southeast Asian mainland located along the China Sea, and the Pacific, as well as the insular countries of Japan, Taiwan, the Philippines, and Indonesia. The regionalization is in terms of location more than homogenization. It is more strategical than purely geographical regionalization, that is. Likewise, the term Southeast Asia to connote a definite region, inland and insular, is of recent popularity. There is really no cultural, even ethnic homogeneity, but strategically, they may stand or fall together, hence the domino theory. There are indications, however, that geologically and climatically, they belong together. Politically, they all have been former European colonies, and they all have suffered under their masters. This region as such is now a battleground for two great opposing ideologies, democracy and communism. Now, so much for the geographic description of Asia. There's more, of course, to be said about Asia, particularly the culture of Asia. There is also variation in population. Thus, there are nations in the monsoon region that are more or less sparse in population. Countries of Southeast Asia, which may be considered the breadbasket of Asia, are that. And for this reason, they are much desired by communist China and Russia. Political and economic problems arise in this region as a result of the variations in population, let alone the regional disunity resulting in weakness and underdevelopment. Ideological and cultural factors also play a great deal in the slow development of these young nations. India's cultures and religions, for instance, have kept the subcontinent from the accelerated progress that is needed to feed its 500 million people, while people riot because of hunger. Almost 250 million cattle roam the streets and chew the cud, even in the congested cities, while millions of people starve to death. The Indians may kill each other for food, but do not dare butcher a cow. What are the resources of Asia? What do people do to make a living? What competence have they in exploiting their resources? What are the barriers of progress, if there be any? Are the people near the kind of stewards that they should be? Unless the strategist can answer these questions, he cannot hope to formulate a functional strategy that can give assurance of reasonable success in carrying out the mission of the church. To be sure, an acquaintance of the economic geography of each region and all of Asia is called for in answering these questions. It is not within the purview of this presentation to acquaint the reader with the economic geography of Asia. It suffices here, however, to indicate some answers to most of these pertinent questions. The fact that the alluvial plains along the rivers are thickly populated shows that the Asians are mostly agrarian. Hence, Asia has an agricultural subsistence. But from the agricultural production, the average Asian is underfed. The caloric intake of the Asian is less than 2,000, much less than the minimum requirement of 2,600 calories per person. A badly unbalanced diet only worsens the general nutritional deficiency. In addition to this, the poverty among the Asians and compliance with their religious laws gives many of them no chance for healthful existence. Consequently, death claims its great toll among the malnourished and undernourished. Since agriculture is insufficient as a means of livelihood, relief must come from somewhere. But Asians have pride and therefore do not want to be a nation of beggars. They need the development of their resources, agricultural and mineral. They need the scientific know-how and the kind of efficiency that increases production. Perhaps an industrialized economy will help solve their economic problems as they advance in the technological sciences. For the present, they need the means of producing scientific fertilizer in order to increase agricultural output. The industrialization of Asia is handicapped not only because Asians at the present time do not have the competence and skill to industrialize their economy, but also because the means of industrialization are not available. Coal and oil are not localized in abundance, and available deposits are far from areas of manufacture. There is much coal in China, but it does not have quality iron ore in quantity. There is oil in certain islands of insular Asia, but this has to be brought to where there are raw materials for heavy industrialization. Retarded economically because of foreign colonial encroachment, if not control, Asians do not realize, even up to now, that they must take the initiative in developing their economy. Foreign aid, to be realistic, cannot develop Asian economy, for the aid received usually falls into the hands of the unscrupulous few. But what bearing has the knowledge of the economic geography of Asia have on the church's mission strategy? For one thing, it is a part of the mission of the church to involve itself in the enlightenment of the whole man. For another thing, human welfare is also a part of the mission of the church. In a word, the church is committed to helping people help themselves. It cannot be true to itself by closing its eyes to the ignorance and poverty of people whether they are Africans or Asians. The short section on the historical geography of that very thickly populated region of the world. The historical geography of Asia is very broad, a very broad subject which would take the student to the far distant past. In the case of the Asian Southwest, we would have to delve into the very remote history of the ancient Asians, the Sumerians and the succeeding Babylonian, Chaldean and Persian civilizations. It would take the student back to the study of the nomadic Semitic Babylonians, which include the people of Israel. These civilizations had their respective historical geographic locales, resulting in the distinctive national groups occupying definite space and confines. Thus, the Aryans suddenly appeared in history in a definite geographic scene in Persia, leaving behind them a civilization in both Iran and Western India and the Indus Valley. Much later, the Greeks came under Alexander the Great, conquering that part of the world, including Egypt in northern Africa. Thus, the political map of the Middle East, of the ancient cradle of civilization, was changed by new people. The Romans followed the Greek conquerors. They had a prolonged life as a colonial power, whose territories included most of the known inhabited world of their times. The political and historical fabric of the Far East dates back to many centuries in the past. It was already noted that the Aryans had settled in the Indus Valley over 2,000 years before the Christian era. At about the same time, a high degree of civilization was already in existence in the North and Central Northeast Asia. The old Chinese emperors had succeeded in uniting the territory under a form of social discipline that predated the Platonic ideal of philosopher kings. The Confucian classics are restatements of what these ancient emperors had supposedly tried to do in the past. To preserve their way of life, the emperors had tried to wall off would-be invaders from their domain. The historical geography of China had been somewhat enlarged by the Mongol invaders under the great Khans, but from the time of their fall from power, China became progressively reduced. The old empire had disintegrated. It was divided into different spheres of influence under feudal warlords. Weakened by dissension and open warfare, China was not able to ward off either Russian penetration or Japanese territorial claims on Manchuria after their conquest of Korea. Indeed, even before the emperors disappeared from the Chinese historical scene, European colonial powers were able to impose their will on China and were on the verge of partitioning it when America appeared on the scene to stop the dismemberment of the great empire. So, as it were, America had been a savior of China. It is not possible, of course, to write in great detail about the historical and political geography of China in a chapter of a short book, just as it is impossible to write in detail the separate historical and political geography of each individual national entity in Asia. But one can see from this difficulty that the mission strategist and or missionary cannot but be overwhelmed by the body of knowledge that should be known before one can be certain of an effective strategy, say, in Asia. Now, as far as cultural geography is concerned, culture does not merely happen. Culture here, in its geographic sense, is merely what man does in his relation to space or to the area of his domain. What did the Asians do in their domain in the light of their historical past? What are they doing now did each nation of Asia fulfill faithfully the kind of stewardship that would contribute to the happiness of its people. Culture, in a more restrictive sense, is the cultivation of man on an ethical or moral basis. This includes development and progression in the arts and sciences. Thus, in considering the Asian regions, one by one, the student will find advance as well as regression and retrogression. In the Middle East, for instance, there were several successions of cultures. To study each culture that existed and separate it from its fusion with other cultures is a great task. Yet it may be necessary to study the past culture of the Middle East in order to understand the present or the developing culture. It is a study that leads to a sound interpretation of the region's cultural history, consequently resulting in certain valuable insights that would lead to a workable strategy. In the Middle East, Southwest Asia, or Near East, one can see in today's clashes of cultures and ancient heritage working for or against the interests of the whole region. But one must go to the past to understand the present. The nomadic culture, which, despite its antiquity, is still alive in certain areas of the Middle East, has been rivaled by rural cultures. As a matter of fact, two religions have resulted from clashes of these two cultures. Measured in terms of religious ethics, no doubt, there have been great advances. For instance, for indeed, the Near East has produced the most advanced religions in the world. For instance, ethical monotheism is shared by these religions, such as Judaism and Islam. Another indication of the progress of the region is the discovery of communication through the use of the written word. They, the people of this region, reduced their languages into written symbols, thereby developing the use of the alphabet and written script. The accurate rules of speech, grammar, and rhetoric point out to the discovery of logic in communication. Written literature, such as the Old Testament and the Quran, have shown this progress and this score. Eastward into Iran or Persia, one can see a developing culture that also produced a religion. This was due to the development of a more advanced rural culture and different social needs. The call of the kine was a response to the challenge to do away with the wastage of animals and other resources of the land. Zoroastrianism and its concept of deity was a definite advance from the wasteful, amoral religions of the Aryans. The ethics of Zoroastrianism were indeed a definite shift toward progress in Iranian culture. No doubt because of a superior ethical standard, the Persians saw in Judaism what they had come to appreciate in ethical monotheism. To this end, they were friendly to the Jewish exiles whom they had inherited from the former Babylonians. As a matter of fact, these Persian rulers encouraged and helped the exiles to return to Jerusalem and rebuild the city and the temple. The subcontinent, India, cradled a number of great religions that have affected every vein of human culture. Was it the physical geography of India and the climate that had predisposed humankind in that part of Asia to become more religious than others? Hinduism, the mother of them all, Jainism, Buddhism, Sikhism, and later another religion which was foreign to the people here enjoyed hospitality. In the name of religion, four main castes and hundreds of and even thousands of subcastes that are mutually exclusive came into existence as an integral part of the culture. Religion affected the thinking and lives of the Indians. It is not an accident of history to see the Jains engage only in non-agricultural professions. It is not accidental that 250 million cattle roam and the countryside and even streets of India while millions of men and women are hungry and die of hunger every year. No doubt, in numerical strength, there are more religious people in the subcontinent than in most regions of the world, not barring any nation in Europe. Indeed, it is true that religion has affected the material culture of the people of the subcontinent. There are those, for instance, who desire no wealth and would prefer utter poverty to affluence. There are those who would deny themselves pleasure and even good health in order to become more worthy of a higher status in the next existence. Such people would not care to have their country industrialized and become subordinated to machines. Most Hindus are thus minded. Therefore, technological culture will be long in coming. Yet India and its religious culture, if we call it thus, have not been without influence in the West. As a matter of fact, it has been said that the thought of Asia has been the basis of all European religions. The religions of Asia are much thought of and certainly discussed in Western countries. Yet, it is not altogether true that the West has not affected Asia and the subcontinent of India. Like 11, Western thought, ideas, and religion have influenced not a few in Asia. Saintly sages from the West are admired by Asians, for they match the lives of many of their teachers. The religion of the cross has been responsible for this admiration. Religious Asians do admire Christianity when lived by those who profess it. Western culture, as affected by Christianity, is admired everywhere and is admired by perceptive Asians. Pride and arrogance, however, are deprecated by them. The strategist must remember this. The new strategy may have to be easy, and the propagation of what is Western per se, and make Asians see nothing but Christ only. If the material culture of the West is superior, let Asians be the judge, for they recognize the superiority of Western technology to the extent of copying it and including the defects. The spiritual aspects of Western culture may be accepted on their own merit. Thus, the high-pressure sales method of presenting Christianity would only depreciate Christianity among them. The policy of attraction is better appreciated. Asians, by temperament, would sooner see Christianity in action and experience it in their lives than have it presented to them sugar-coated as superior in comparison and contrast to things Asian. North of the Himalayas are deserts, wastelands. But even here, men have developed civilizations and cultures that are indigenous to the region. They express this in their way of life, in what they do. Here too, religion has been given a distinctive flavor. The rulers are often given function of the divine. This is true of Tibet and even of China and Japan. People here, depending much on what they benefit from nature, spend much of their time in religious contemplation. Buddhism, therefore, has been and still is an attractive philosophy to them. The chief expression of the cultures of Southeast Asia, too, is religious in life and practices. Islam and Hinayana Buddhism have caught their fancy.
and interest. Thailand and Indochina are Buddhist by choice, and Indonesia and parts of southern Philippines have become Muslim more by choice than by conquest. The many temples and images of Buddha, Gautama, the yellow-colored habits of the monks are evidence of the religious bent of Southeast Asia's heart and mind. The many minarets and the practices of unashamed display of religiousness in prayerful devotions as they face toward the direction of Mecca are telltale marks of the people's piety. Since the Southeast Asians became either Mohammedans or Buddhists by choice, they're found to be more tolerant of those who differ from them in religion. It is not unusual for a Muslim young man to escort a Christian girl in Indonesia, for instance. As in most of Asia, however, Southeast Asians have a rural culture. But most of these young nations are underdeveloped, showing that the European colonial regime has not helped but rather retarded the development of a regional culture, except in agriculture. The nationalistic tendency of these people, the tendency to depreciate the contributions of colonial masters, indicates the disenchantment and resentment that they feel. To this end, they show resentment to things that remind them of the West, as well as resistance to what they deem to be impositions from the West. Under the circumstances, what might be the right strategy of missions? In order to win over Southeast Asians to Christianity, a strategy of attraction or reconciliation is certainly indicated here. The practical mind of the North Central, Northeast Asian predisposes the population to materialism. The people in this region are familistic and emphasize the human relationship more than the divine human relationship. The tendency to venerate ancestors and to honor their elders is strong. The climatic conditions are conducive to technological industrialization. Actually, religion has only been an expression of their practical mind. Confucianism and Taoism, in the case of the Chinese people, are more philosophical than religious. It was not until the champions of the way, Taoism, who defied the founders, did they become religious, and this by imperial edict. The Japanese, too, found Shintoism a way of uniting the people of Japan into one nation. Accordingly, corporate worship is not in general practice in Shintoism. If they are religious, they are not like the Hindus or the Muslims or the Zoroastrians. And so as one friend of mine in Japan said, my people are very, very materialistic. It is hard to do mission work among them. Quotation from Pastor Shibata. There was a time in the past when Chinese civilization and culture reached a remarkable stage of development. Thus, Chinese inventions and discoveries of certain principles of social discipline and relationships show a superior stage of cultural development. These inventions and discoveries have intrigued the Western mind, and justly so. Chinese pottery of exquisite beauty, the invention of Chinese writing, and a somewhat common language took place centuries ago. Thus, the Mongoloid Chinese, Koreans, and Japanese have shown that there are variations in Asian culture due to circumstances of history as well as geography. In the past as in the present, these northern countries show evidence of superiority over other Asians in civilization and culture. All indicate a different kind of mission strategy. Korea and Japan were culturally related with China in the past. It is said that Mongoloid Koreans and Mongoloid Japanese still retain Confucian thoughts. Japan, however, to unite its people under one government and under one ruler, nationalized a legend. Japan was the first creation, according to this legend, and the Mikado descended from the sun goddess. This belief has been perpetuated by the national religion of Shinto. No doubt this gave stability to the nation. Thus, up to our times, the emperor has been the rallying point of the Japanese in the defense of their land or in their wars of conquest. As a military clique arose to aggrandize the nation and the race, the emperor became the tool with which the nation was inspired toward frenzied nationalism that would make it the most honorable thing, to fight and perish for the Mikado. The national flag, the red sun, constantly reminded the Japanese of their nation, of the Mikado, of the sun goddess who gave them their islands and their ruler. Thus, the war culture of Japan was born and reached its climax when the Japanese invaded the Asian mainland, took possession of Korea and Manchuria, defeated the Russians in a major war, and subsequently became a world power. The Japanese were now drunk with power. They were now imbued with the idea that they had a mission to conquer. Thus, they tried to conquer all of Asia. In their fanatical desire to carry out their mission, they dared to attack the greatest world power of our times, America. In time, Buddhism entered Japan. There were Japanese intellectuals at the time who were meditative, retaining much of Confucian ideas. This religion of contemplation had attracted this class to itself, winning many of them. Thus, a new religion came to Japan. No doubt it was tolerable to the Japanese nationalists in that it did not seek to destroy Shintoism. It did not seek to replace it, for in Buddhism, one could be anything else, for it did not have a god to worship. The Japanese are imaginative, adaptable, practical-minded. They see what is practical in other cultures and are not hesitant about copying what they feel may be useful to them. Thus, when they were finally freed from their national ghetto by Commodore Perry, there began a period of their history when they could copy from Western cultures, especially European and American. In a sense, they made profit from Western technology than Westerners themselves. In the light of what the mission strategist knows about Japan geographically and historically, what might be the most effective strategy? This is food for thought, for Christianity has not gained much headway in Japan despite its century-old existence there. Whereas the Japanese assimilated much of the material culture of the West, they have been reluctant in adopting the spirit of the West, including its religions. Well, there's more to be said, but I'm sure you are tired by now, so I would better end up here. Thank you.